Steve, what's the pool say when we're getting out of here?
2 weeks.
All right. Long trip. Thank you.
I just lost. I said Wednesday.
Uh-huh. Well, last week I predicted Tuesday night, so I've lost also.
I think I know.
There'll be many more pools, probably.
6 p.m. on Wednesday.
Did you say what week?
That might be my saving grace. Now, I'd be accused of giving a lawyer's technical argument to not have to stay off the bench. Today we're here to primarily address H.J.R. 2 and Senate Bill 1340, which are in response to the Lakin versus Senko Oregon Supreme Court decision last week. As everyone knows, we're late in the session. If that decision would have come down earlier, we would have spent more time on it, but that's not possible at this late date. And so what I'm going to do is we're in work session on H.J.R. 2, and we're in public hearing on Senate Bill 1340, and I've asked the proponents to divide their time. I have the list here, the information's been passed out. But we'll begin with proponents. I'll call Scott Gallant, Jim Gardner, and Mark Bonanno. And I'm sorry, Mark, you testified several times before, and I've missed your name several times before. You'll be known always to me as Mark. and then Larry will testify on behalf of the Trial Association. The committee briefly discussed the Supreme Court decision in our last hearing on Saturday, and so we will begin committee. You should have in front of you some written testimony, and do we have a hand engrossed copy of the bill also?
Mr. Chair, you have a newly hand engrossed bill, not what you had last week. H.R. 2, this is -89. The only difference is 1-7-B, where it's not there. Notwithstanding any other provision of this legislature may impose limitations. And then you have the A9 amendments. You have a fifth one, the A7. I expect the fifth one, the A9, to look the exact same, but the fiscal reflects the cost of referring it to the voters, not the content of the amendment itself. So.
Do you want the A9 amendment?
Yes. And the LC we had last time, the LC 4330, is now Senate Bill 1340.
Sure.
Thank you.
Chair, just a comment. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but apparently today is the day of the National American Trial Lawyers Association, so the trial lawyers' numbers were down, so we were lucky to even get one member to be here with us today. So,
well, we thank Larry for being here, and I did not plan when the Supreme Court decision would come down. So I wasn't in control of that, and I'm sure the trial lawyers would have liked it to have been delayed another week or two.
Yeah.
So,
maybe we could hold it.
Mr. Gallant, who would like to?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, first, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. With me today is Mr. Jim Gardner, who will be testifying on his own behalf, and Mark Bonanno, who is with CUNY and Crew. CUNY and Crew filed and amicus brief on behalf of the Medical Association in this particular case. And we, too, have been scrambling as well to get people notified and aware of this. But I thought that it would be appropriate if you had any questions specifically regarding the constitutional issues before the court that he would be available. I'm also representing at the moment 68 organizations, businesses, and associations in support of H.J.R. 2 and Senate Bill 1340. And I'd like to just briefly take you back to 1978. I was here in 87, excuse me.
As a high school senior.
Right. Where a broad, statewide broad coalition proposed court reform because of of the liability climate in the state, where OB-GYN family practice physicians, seated Christians, and others, as well as businesses, nonprofits, charitable associations, and others, were having an incredibly difficult time in obtaining insurance coverage. And in response to that, after having a bill, a few bills introduced at the beginning of that session on the first week of the session, a bipartisan vote of both Democrats and Republicans signed what is today the law that in part has been challenged, has been overturned by the state Supreme Court. And the reason that the legislature, I believe, adopted the cap on non-economic damages was to do two things: to assist in assuring the availability of insurance coverage for a wide variety of entities and organizations, as well as to provide some stability. My recollection at, is that at the time, it was suggested that the non-economic damage cap would not have any impact on premiums, even if it were adopted. The experience of the Oregon Medical Association, who does in fact sponsor a malpractice program for its members, has seen its premiums go down 50% since the adoption of the non-economic damage cap, and we believe that this has been a major contributing factor for that. What the Supreme Court essentially said was that the word inviolate means today what it did 142 years ago, and that the common law understanding of today is in fact enforced, in spite of the fact that the Oregon Constitution also provides in Article 18, Section 7, that it is the legislature, provides that the legislature has the right to alter or repeal all law. So fundamentally, the Supreme Court decision has said to the state legislature that you do not have the authority to adopt by statute reasonable parameters or limitations in civil action. That is a huge decision. The only alternative to determine whether or not the legislature in fact does have that authority is a constitutional amendment, which is proposed by HJR2 and that we support. The Senate bill 1340 merely says that upon if the Constitution is amended, then the non-economic damage cap, which was adopted by the legislative body, would become effective. I'll end my comments there and turn to Mr. Sargent.
And in 1987, Governor Goldschmidt was the governor.
That is correct.
And you know, the Senate was controlled by the Democrats.
The Senate president was John Kitzhaber, and the speaker was Jerry Hess. It was a majority of Democrats. It was a bipartisan bill. It was a difficult bill to get to that point. Believe me, some people suggested I looked like walking death. And I felt like it. But it was something that bipartisan vote adopted.
Mr. Gardner, we'll hold our questions until all three of us are done.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I am appearing today in a somewhat unusual capacity. I'm speaking for myself. We do have clients that I'm confident will be taking a position on this issue, but have not yet done so. And so, given that situation, I thought that that I wanted, because I feel very strongly about this issue, I wanted to make my own views about it known, and we will be communicating with you concerning our positions of our clientele in due course. Just by way of background, I did previously serve as a member of this committee for three sessions, the Senate Judiciary Committee, And before that, I had an opportunity to serve as a law clerk for Ted Goodwin on the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, and then for Justice Potter Stewart on the United States Supreme Court. In 1987, I, along with Scott, was heavily involved as a lobbyist in passage of the tort reform package, which was recently invalidated in large part by the Oregon Supreme Court in the Lakin case. So I say that by way of background and to illustrate that I've thought a lot about the issue of the allocation of power between legislatures and courts, and how that relationship evolves, how it changes, and it's one of the, I think, one of the most important public policy issues that we face. We face it on an ongoing basis. It is extremely important that this committee focus on what is really at stake in the aftermath of Lakin as an institutional matter. As the Supreme Court pointed out explicitly in Lakin, this was a decision about power, the power of the legislature, and by necessary implication, the power of the people of Oregon to define remedies for tort actions versus the power of a majority of the justices of the Oregon Supreme Court to pronounce the limits of democratic self-rule on the basis of their reading of the jurisprudence of 1857.
Jim, we'll have to stop you there. We've got a call on the Senate, so we'll go up and vote and come back.
And as the Oregon Supreme Court pointed out explicitly in Lakin, this was a decision about power, the power of the legislature, and by necessary implication, the power of the people of Oregon to define remedies for tort action versus the power of a majority of the justices of the Oregon Supreme Court to pronounce the limits of democratic self-rule on the basis of their reading of the jurisprudence of 1857. The fundamental problem with the Oregon Supreme Court's decision in Lakin is that it is profoundly anti-democratic. The court is telling us explicitly that the democratically elected legislature possesses no power whatsoever to respond to changing times and conditions, no power to deviate from the principles of tort law in effect in 1857. I submit to you that this is an untenable situation. How can we deal with it? We can ask the people of Oregon to amend the Oregon Constitution to clarify that Oregonians and their elected representatives, now and in the future, are entitled to the basic right of democratic self-rule. That's what the resolution before you would do if adopted by the people. And I urge your support for this resolution and for the accompanying legislative measure.
Thank you. Mark.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mark Bonanno. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Cooney & Crew, which serves as general counsel to the Oregon Medical Association, and I was one of the attorneys that filed an amicus brief on behalf of that association, and I'm here today simply to concur with the statements of Scott Gallant and answer any questions that the committee may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Thanks for your testimony. Next we have Lawrence Whopper. We will find them. Larry, tell me that you didn't have your plane reservation booked, that you were planning on being in Oregon anyway. You look awfully tan.
My sons are home from college, and I'm going to take a park vacation tomorrow, so I missed the convention this year, but if I'd have known this was coming up, I'm sure I would have had everybody else here. Everybody else would have missed it, too. Well, thanks for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, to be here. I guess I'm here to make a record, but this is something I, too, feel very strongly about. I've had the privilege of representing injured people for 22 years. I'm former president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I think, in part, this is about respect for the process and how this process works. I know that you're faced with this issue with the waning days of your session, but this is an issue that I participated in debates in 1987. I was here almost every day when this was considered, and it was considered carefully and argued about at great length by both sides. it was on the books for 12 years, and it took that long for a case to work its way through the system and get an opinion last Thursday. After 22 months of consideration by the Supreme Court, and I think you know that that was a unanimous opinion. And so the question becomes, why do we need at this 11th hour, without much opportunity to present evidence and to present what is now available to you in the form of empirical evidence, is there an emergency? What's the need for this? What is the crisis that requires that you do this now? In fact, if you do this now, it will, it's my understanding, be referred to the people in May of 2000, and 6 months later, your session will start, 7 months later then. So why is there such a crisis that you need a seven-month lead time to have this law be referred to the people instead of taking evidence and having it considered in your process in which you can actually hear the facts and look at some of the evidence that is not really possible in the kind of public debate that's going to be dealt with in 30-second sound bites and commercials on TV sponsored by the proponents and the opponents of this referral. So what is some of the evidence that's available to you? Well, there was a civil action data form that was required under the 1987 court reform that required that we as attorneys file at the end of every verdict and judgment and settlement data with the Supreme Court to let you know what the verdicts were, what the amount of economic damages were, what the amount of non-economic damages were, what the amount of attorney fees were. And about halfway through the last 12 years, for some reason, that was simply abandoned. But there's probably, by law, by statute, my understanding, there is some data that's available there that lets you know. There's also data now, much more data available than we had in 1987, about the amount of verdicts that are returned in the state. My own personal experience is that I know of less than 18 verdicts in the history of this state exceeding $1 million in personal injury cases. 18 verdicts. This is about 18 verdicts. With that 12 years of experience, what was the basis of the passage of this law in the first place? And when we look back, was it true? Well, we were told there was an insurance availability crisis and a price crisis. And we were just told by Mr. Gallant for the OMA that this limitation on damages has somehow made insurance more available. But one of the things we know is that there was a phenomenon known as cash flow underwriting back in 1987, where insurance companies were peddling their insurance at basically a loss to get the business, hoping to invest it and make a return on that investment. And that's where they'd make their money. But when the investment cycle turned down, we now know in retrospect they couldn't make as much money, so they had to make up for their mistake and jack up their premiums. And that's why there was a availability crisis then, because they had charged too little and they couldn't cover the losses when they incurred because they hadn't charged the appropriate premiums. We know now that instead of two medical malpractice insurance companies in the state as there once was, there is now six. We know that CNA, who once wrote 85 to 90% of the market for the OMA, Mr. Gallant's client, we now know that they write 50% of the market, and they have to compete again on the basis of price to get the business. And the cycle is going to start again with cash flow underwriting. We know that the basis of the crisis in 1987 is not borne out by the facts. It was more of an effort of publicity, PR efforts to build a so-called crisis to get people like yourselves to institute radical legislation. And that's exactly what happened. But we look back at that, the facts of that circumstance, and there was no actual basis for it. Now, you don't have to take my word for it. In a more considered environment, you can have hearings on that. You can allow us to present the evidence. You can look at the facts and see, is there an emergency? Is there really an emergency that requires that you do this at the 11th hour? And if you wait until the next session, you won't have to do it at the 11th hour. You can do it in a considered manner and see if it's really required. If you look at the facts as to medical malpractice, for example, which Mr. Gallant spoke to, is there a medical malpractice crisis? Well, the government the Congressional Budget Office studied the issue of medical malpractice and found out that if you eliminated the entire liability system for doctors, eliminated it completely, in other words, doctors were immune, you wouldn't decrease the cost of medicine by more than 1%, because the cost of the liability system to the medical system is less than 1% of the entire medical care budget in this country in any given year. And I've handed to you and refer you to column 3 from Business Week, the Economic Viewpoint article by Robert Kuttner, the Trumped Up Case Against Damage Awards. And that statistic is right there on the third column, second paragraph. Some of the things that you might want to reconsider, too, is it fair to impose a cap on damages that does not take into account the cost of living? Other states that have attempted at this have at least added that part to it. Is it fair to impose a cost of a cap on damages that doesn't take into account reckless or wanton or intentional conduct on the part of the wrongdoer? Some states, such as Idaho, have considered that and eliminate the cap when those elements exist. Those are things that need your considered judgment and not something done again at the 11th hour. In a time when business in this country and the economy is doing better than ever, it seems to us in the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association that it is unfair to pick on the most defenseless people, and granted, those that have very little in the form of a lobby on their behalf, if it isn't us, the trial lawyers, and that's the injured, the profoundly injured people. Let me explain one of the effects of this cap on the catastrophically injured. It discriminates, first of all, against children and women who don't work and elderly people, in that their damage limitations are limited to their economic damages, but if they're severely injured and they're retired and they can't work anymore, then they're not fully compensated because the jury may return a verdict of $1 million for their pain and suffering and loss of enjoyment of life. They're paraplegic, they're bedbound, they're brain damaged, and yet the court will be forced to reduce that to $500,000. Where someone else that suffers a relatively minor whiplash injury in a car wreck, their pain and suffering up to $500,000 is fully compensated. But the children, the elderly, and those that aren't seen as economic engines have their enjoyment of life and their pain and suffering limited to $500,000. I can give you only a personal experience. I've had the privilege of representing people in the courts in the state for 22 years, as I mentioned. I represent people in medical malpractice cases. I'll tell you about one case I tried probably 5 years ago now. And I only tell you this as an example. I represented a woman in Benton County, not known for its big verdicts. She was the victim of medical malpractice at a local clinic. She was working part-time and made about $11,000 a year. As a consequence of malpractice, she lost both of her legs below the knee and all the fingers on both of her hands. Now, Benton County juries, maybe in the hands of a better lawyer, would have done a better job for her, but returned a verdict of $2,300,000. Of that, $1,300,000 was for her future care in the way of assistance and modification of the home, someone to help her with the housework, fire prosthesis, those sort of things. $1,000,000 was for her pain and suffering. She'd lost both of her legs below the knees, all the fingers on her both of her hands, to a condition known as the DIC, diffuse intravascular coagulopathy, caused by a misdiagnosis with a very bad disease. Who's to say that that jury was unreasonable? Who's to say that this legislature should impose its wisdom as to what the cap should be over what that jury said? And I think when we reflect back on what's important in this country, I don't think it's appropriate to disparage the founding fathers of this state constitution when they knew that allowing juries to make those kinds of decisions was the only way. And to say that somehow to allow juries to make that decision or to allow the court to uphold that doctrine is somehow profoundly undemocratic, as the former speaker said. I think, flies in the face of the most democratic of all of our institutions, and that's the jury. The jury that makes the decision on an individual basis. If you take your car, if your car gets wrecked and you take it to the insurance company, the insurance company wants to look at it before they write you a check for damages. They want to evaluate it. They don't have a one-size-fits-all of $500, or in the case of the cap that they're contemplating putting before the people, $500,000. They have the insurance company people look at the car and assess the damages. Don't we owe that much, at least, for individuals? Have a jury look at the people, hear about their lives, and assess the damages accordingly? And the founding fathers that established the right to trial by jury and respected it from their forefathers in the English system, the English tradition, knew that. And knew that having any sort of administrative body or legislative body say one size fits all is going to be injustice, because some people are hurt more than $500,000. And to say today that everybody from now on, $500,000 is the value of the pain and suffering and loss and enjoyment of life, they thought was a respected notion to say that that's unfair. Allow a jury to make those determinations. Just like you have your car looked at. Give it at least that amount of respect. If there are changing times and conditions, as one of the speakers previously said, that require that the Constitution be rewritten, at least evidence should be taken on that. Is there an insurance crisis? Was the past crisis really legitimate? Do juries return excessive verdicts? Are juries unreasonable? Why is it that doctors win 85% of the malpractice cases? Is it an unfair system for when the plaintiff wins 15% of the time? Why is it that companies win product liability cases 60% of the time to 75% of the time? Is that a crisis? Is insurance unavailable? So to say that the times require a reexamination, I think requires that you do that. And not just simply put this before the people. It sort of begs the question and assumes that there's a problem. There isn't a problem. Oregon juries are known throughout the country to be conservative. We have some of the most conservative juries in the 50 states. This is not a place, if you want to make a lot of money, to be a court lawyer. I'm a plaintiff's lawyer. And so I would ask you once again to please consider carefully what you're about to do. Allow the process to actually work. Allow evidence to be presented before you. Don't rush it. There's no crisis. There's no emergency. I presented to you some materials that were available in 1987. It's sad to say, but maybe an underlying commentary, that the arguments that were presented then are just as valid as they are now. Everyone wants to talk about the McDonald's case, and this material is the what you might call true facts of the McDonald's case. You'll see that it's not as outlandish as everyone would like to portray. And finally, the article from Business Week that talks about the trumped up case against damage awards. I want to thank you. I've gone on a little long. I know you're under a lot of pressure these waning days of legislation. I want to thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you, Larry. And as always, you give a good closing statement. Other questions?
You heard Jim Gardner's discussion about power branches of government and the power and sort of would like your response. The power of the legislature to define remedies for tort actions versus the power of the majority of the justices of Oregon to pronounce the limits of democratic self-rule.
Well, at one point, I think the power of the people has attempted to be balanced. You know, the court's opinion not only incorporates the right to trial by jury, which I think gives the most power to the people, but also incorporates a referendum amendment to the Constitution, Article 3, Section 7, that says all questions of fact decided by a jury shall not be re-examined by a court. Both of those statements, both in the Constitution and in that referendum, the people did speak, and they say we want juries to decide fact questions, and one of the major fact questions, this is the nut of the opinion, I want juries to decide fact questions, and one of the fact questions is the amount of damages. And that is profoundly, I think, democratic. I mean, juries, unlike any other group in our society, are not put up by special interests, are not, do not run political campaigns, as even judges do, do not take anything into account except the facts that are presented to them at the time they hear the case. And that system has proven to be so important that it's been written into every constitution in every state in this country, and of course in our national constitution, and to say somehow things have radically changed since that provision was put into our constitution requires, I think, some fact-finding on your part. Okay, what are the changes? What's happened? And if you send it to the people in the current form, you beg the question, you say there's a problem. There isn't a problem. Now, sure, everybody would like not to have to buy insurance. Everybody would like not to ever be stuck as a tortfeasor and found liable for causing injury to someone else, but that's not the real world, and we have a system that attempts to compensate people fairly, and juries, we have found, are the best system for that. But to say that somehow juries, we believe in them on one side, but then when they do something we don't like, we don't believe in them, is profoundly undemocratic.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. That will conclude then the public hearing on Senate Bill 1340. And let's go into work session on House Bill 2394. Colleagues, this is a bill that we discussed on the looting. We now have amendments that I think everyone's in agreement on. Mr. Taylor?
Chairman, as a committee, you should have before you the Dash 14 amendments. And basically what they do for someone who's been looting police and then assaults someone in an accident or seriously hurts them, or has done so in an accident after being intoxicated and having three prior convictions, what this would do would increase the severity of the penalty. So if it were currently now manslaughter 2, it would now become manslaughter 1. If it were assault 3, it would become assault 4. You can look at the language in page 2 that sets forth the conditions as it relates to manslaughter in the first degree becoming murder. Those conditions appear in all the different pages as it relates to particular crimes. And as it relates to the issue of driving under the influence, you can look in page 3 in lines 11 through 16 where it sets the affirmative offensive charge of violating the section. The victim was at least 18 years of age, was voluntarily in the vehicle, and had reasonable grounds to be aware of the defendant's intoxication. So if someone gets killed in a car accident and they knew or should have known it, or should have heard that the driver was under the influence, then it would be a defense for the driver. I had
these are the D14.
I discussed them in English once, and I discussed the concepts with Keith Meisenheimer, the one with the A's office, but given the closeness of time these days, I haven't been able to get a copy to him.
Ray, this is one, if you recall, the bill that came to us from Ways and Means that allowed for enhancement, even if you were charged and not convicted. It had some other verbiage problems, and we could testimony on it for about a half an hour, and it was fairly complicated, so we sent it back to legislative council and gave direction on what we were interested in. I think this addresses that.
I'll move to Dash 14.
Thank you. Senator Duncan moves the Dash D14 amendments to House Bill 2394. Discussion? Objection for order. Duncan then moves HB 2394 as amended to the floor with the due path recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Or, Vern, would you carry?
You trust me?
Sure. Okay. Thank you. We'll now go into work session on HJR 2. Committee, the points about the shortness of time, I am sympathetic with because, as you know, I like the hearing process and believe that is the normal course of democracy. It's also the normal course of democracy that We try to conclude the legislative session, and we have a Supreme Court decision that was handed down last Thursday. But the chair feels deserves a response. What the HJR 2 does will refer to the people in the next primary election. I would call would be the status quo before the court decision, which would allow the legislature in its process, the Republican form of legislature, to have the authority to set limits on caps. We can't do it statutorily anymore. It affects not only the case or the statute that was before the court, but the other statutes we passed while I've been here, before I've been here, that impose caps in certain instances. It would also, I think, affect the things we did in the tort reform in 95 and subjects like punitive damages. The constitutional arguments that were made probably in 87, I imagine they had the Attorney General's opinion and the Legislative Council opinion saying that these things were all right. Obviously, the Supreme Court disagreed. But the discussion isn't what the cap should be. I think that is a legislative decision, whether or not there should be caps at all, whether or not we chose on punitive damages not to have caps. It just did determine how the dollars would be divided. The cost of living adjustments, that isn't something that will be in HDR 2, but I think when you have caps, that is something that should be discussed, and probably in most instances it either should be allowed or the legislature should review those caps on a regular basis because the cost of things do change. But,
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I know we're talking a lot cost, and I'm just curious if we have any information to verify. Larry Wilbach said that there have been less than 18 verdicts in the history of the state exceeding $1 million. And if nothing else, I think it would be good for us to verify that and the information, any data that we have from the 1987 legislation requiring the Supreme Court to...
I think that's a good idea. We'll see what we have available. I've also asked Legislative Council to give me a list of all the statutes that are presently on the books that would be or could be affected by the Supreme Court's decision. I mean, you have before you the -A9 amendments to HJR 2. I did have several lobbyists come up today and wondered what we were going to do about nudity. They'll be... Most people, anyway, will be relieved by the -A9. The chair would move the -A9 amendments to HJR 2. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, I was going to object, but I'm not sure. I can't decide whether I like this better than the current version of the bill or not.
Thank you. Hearing no objection, motion carries. The chair then would move HJR 2 as amended before due pass. There will be opportunity to do more discussion on the House side as this bill moves forward, and I know that will take place. Please indicate as objecting Senator Brown, Senator Courtney.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Courtney.
We're amending the Constitution, not
mm-hmm.
this session, not Mr. Chair.
We're referring things to the people on amendment, yep.
To the amending, we're in the Constitution.
Correct. Now, this particular one, a court decision, you can't affect it without an amendment. There are others we're referring that are not in response to a court decision, although Armada and the Sixth HJRs were in response to a court decision. Other comment? Indicate Senator Brown and Senator Courtney is objecting. Passes.
I'll also serve notice in the nudity report.
You're going to go back to nudity?
Well, who knows where we'll go at this point. But, Mr. Chair, since it looks like we're not going to be on a short leash to get out of here, we might as well take the time and consider all the issues that are available to us.
All right. Thank you. Please note, Senator Brown, serve notice of the minority report joined by Senator Courtney.
And as I say, since this one was going to be another 2 weeks here, I do think perhaps that allows us to consider bringing the bill back to committee for further in-depth discussion, since you've indicated here on the record you believe in the public hearing process.
I do.
So it seems to me we can spend a lot more time, 2 weeks at least, Mr. here to thoroughly analyze what we've just done here in just the last several minutes.
Well, if we're here for two more weeks, we'll also probably need therapy as part of it.
Unfortunately, we didn't increase the cap on mental health charity sufficiently enough to cover what we'll need.
All right. Well, now go into the first session on Senate Bill 1340. And are there any amendments to this? This would reenact them the statute passed in 1987 dealing with the cap, and it's conditioned upon the people approving HJR 2. Objection? Objection. Please note that Senator Brown and Senator Courtney is objecting.
And please also note that the possibility of the minority court in December.
Thank you.
If you want to thoroughly evaluate what we're doing here in the next 2 weeks.
Thank you. Motion carries. I'll carry the bill. We are...
No, we're not. We're going to be... I think the word adjourned stopped being used in that.
What should I use?
Just...
temporary recess.
We're just... we'll see you, see you tomorrow.
When are we going to have the final dinner?
That's just a preliminary Sunday night dinner. He wants to go back to that. You want more presents, don't you? We are...